Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Thursday, April 7th. I'm June Grosso. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has given so-called dreamers the green light to get their driver's licenses in Arizona. The appeals court permanently blocked an Arizona policy which prohibited young immigrants with deportation deferrals from getting licenses. A legal victory on the state front for President Obama's immigration actions. For the last 4 years, Arizona has been trying to block dreamers, young immigrants who've been granted what's called deferred action status, from getting driver's licenses. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Arizona illegally usurped a power left exclusively to the federal government by creating its own classification of non-citizens, and dreamers can continue to get Arizona driver's licenses. Arizona lawmaker Juan Mendez applauded the decision.
This was a systemic approach to try to keep our communities outside of society. So now that they're going to be able to get driver's license, they'll be able to re-engage in a more purposeful way.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked a series of Obama's executive orders on immigration, and that case is before the Supreme Court. My guests are Professor Stephen Legomski of the Washington University Law School, formerly Chief Counsel of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and Professor Annie Lay of the University of California, Irvine School of Law, the co-director of the Immigration Rights Clinic. Stephen, let's start with the basics. What is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program?
To answer that, I should explain what deferred action itself is. Deferred action is a tool that the various immigration agencies have used pretty consistently since at least the 1970s. And what it does is to say we have only limited resources available for enforcement, therefore we have to set priorities. And deferred action is the tool by which they say this is a group of people who are a low priority for removal, and therefore we're going to temporarily relieve them of the consequences of removal and not go after them. But that temporary reprieve is revocable at any time and for any reason and without any notice. It doesn't create any legal immigration status of any kind. It's merely a reprieve from removal. The particular program you mentioned, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is a policy that says, generally speaking, if you were brought here as a child, meaning under age 16, and you've been living here since June 15, 2007, and you meet a bunch of other criteria as well, including passing background checks and all that, and we find in the exercise of discretion that you merit deferred action, then we will grant it to you.
Annie, how did the Ninth Circuit come to its decision? What was its reasoning?
Well, on Tuesday, the Ninth Circuit affirmed a grant of summary judgment by U.S. District Court Judge Campbell in the District of Arizona, and also affirmed Judge Campbell's entry of a permanent injunction in that case to prevent Arizona from enforcing their policy of denying driver's licenses to individuals who were who received deferred action for childhood arrivals, the program that the administration started in 2012, the DACA program. The court arrived at that decision by considering two constitutional challenges that the Arizona DREAM Act Coalition and other plaintiffs in the case had brought. The first was a challenge to Arizona's policy as being in violation of the Equal Protection Clause, and the second was a challenge that Arizona's policy was preempted by federal immigration law. With respect to the first claim that Arizona's policy violated the Equal Protection Clause, the Ninth Circuit found that it likely did violate the Equal Protection Clause, but ultimately the Ninth Circuit ruled on the preemption grounds, finding that Arizona's policy was an attempt by the state to define its own categories of lawful presence, and that is not permitted under federal law.
Stephen, Annie just spoke of how the Ninth Circuit found that it may well violate the Equal Protection Clause. It also said in the decision, the record does suggest an additional reason for Arizona's policy, a dogged animus against the recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So why didn't the court rely on an equal protection argument?
Oh, I think it probably felt, and I agree with Annie's description of it, and the only thing I would add to that is that, in a way, the equal protection argument and the preemption argument turn on the same thing, because a state violates equal protection if it distinguishes between two groups of people, and it does so in a way that doesn't relate rationally to some legitimate state interest. In this case, the interest it was asserting was really the interest that the federal government has in classifying people. So what the court was really saying was, we're not saying you can't deny driver's licenses to people who are here unlawfully. All we're saying is, one, you can't do so on the basis of unlawful presence if you're defining unlawful presence in a way that conflicts with what the federal government has said. And two, you can't do it discriminatorily. You can't do it for some groups of people who are lawfully present and deny it to others. I think the reason the court didn't want to rely exclusively on the animus argument is that requires just a great deal of evidence. And I don't know if the evidence in the record was something the court really wanted to pass on when it had a much easier ground for ruling the way it did.
The Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments in a case challenging President Obama's executive actions on immigration on April 18th. In an unprecedented move, the House's legal counsel filed a brief on behalf of the entire House on Monday, arguing Obama overstepped his authority. Here's the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan.
We are defending the people not only against an executive overreach. We are defending the people of this country against a growing branch of unelected bureaucrats who are writing our laws.
But it's possible the case will result in a deadlock decision due to the vacancy on the court. Karen Tumlin is the legal director of the National Immigration Law Center.
In order to overturn the lower court's decision, we always needed five justices to vote to do so, and so that remains true today.
A tie would mean Obama's immigration actions won't take effect before he leaves office. I've been talking with Professor Stephen Legomski of the Washington University Law School and Professor Annie Lay of the University of California Irvine School of Law. Stephen, tell me about why a move to file a brief on behalf of the entire House, even though the House Democrats maintain that that brief didn't speak for them and they're going to file their own.
Yeah, well, as your question indicates, this controversy really has broken down along partisan lines, and the Republicans do have a majority in the House and decided to use that to file a brief. You're right, the Democrats have filed their own brief, but they can't speak for the entire House because they are a minority party. Ultimately, I'm somewhat skeptical that it will matter very much. Everybody, including the Supreme Court justices, are well aware of what the various Republicans in Congress think about these executive actions and what the Democrats think. So ultimately, this is going to be decided on legal grounds rather than on partisan grounds, hopefully.
Annie, we've been talking about the Ninth Circuit's decision, and this involves the Fifth Circuit's decision. How is the Fifth Circuit's reasoning so different from the Ninth Circuit's reasoning? Annie?
Yes, as the Ninth Circuit decision from earlier this week in the Arizona driver's license case stated, they found that the 2012 Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program by the administration was a lawful exercise of federal authority. They did not explicitly reach the merits of the Fifth Circuit's decision and said that was a different case and there were some different issues there. But the Ninth Circuit's weighing in on the legality of the DACA program from 2012 should have implications for how people see the legality of the 2014 DAPA program for parents.
And Stephen, what is the decision of the Fifth Circuit? What is the reasoning behind it?
Several issues to deal with. The first issue is whether Texas and the other states even have legal standing to bring the suit. Because in order to bring a suit in federal court, you have to show that you would be harmed in a concrete way by the action that you're challenging. And we could talk about standing if you would like, but there are real problems with the standing issue. And many in the government are hopeful that Chief Justice Roberts in particular, who has in the past expressed very restrictive views on standing, will adhere to that philosophy and strike it down on that ground alone. The Fifth Circuit, however, did find that Texas had standing. It then went on to the merits, and it affirmed the injunction on two grounds. One is it did not believe that the Immigration and Nationality Act authorized these actions, and the other is that it thought the procedure being used was incorrect because the Administrative Procedure Act says that certain government decisions have to be adopted through this fairly elaborate notice and comment procedure, which was not used in this case. Both of those grounds by the Fifth Circuit, at least in my view and the view of most immigration law professors, are very, very shaky. And so I would have to predict that one way or the other, either on standing grounds or on the merits, there will be at least five votes to affirm this program, but we'll have to see what happens.
Well, Annie, do you agree? Because from what I've been reading, a lot of legal experts have been predicting that it might result in a deadlock.
It's possible, and I have seen that commentary out there. But as Stephen says, you know, I think most immigration law scholars and people who have looked at these issues for a long time would agree that the DACA and the DAPA programs were lawful exercises of the administration's authority as vested in it by the Immigration and Nationality Act.
And was the Ninth Circuit on solid ground considering that federal preemption is based on an executive order and not a law passed by Congress?
Yes, I believe so. As the Ninth Circuit set forth in its decisions, it looked at the provisions of the INA carefully and found that the INA, which was enacted by Congress, did give authority to the executive to decide which groups of people it would prioritize for enforcement actions. And pursuant to this authority vested in it by the INA, the administration acted.
Stephen, I have seen so much written about this case, and it has been going on, the executive action on immigration, for so long, the criticism of it. And so would you put yourself on the other side and give me the best argument for a critique of the executive action on immigration, that it's illegal and not within the president's powers?
It's very. I'll try to do that. It's very
tough,
hard,
huh?
Mainly because the critics have yet to identify a single provision of either the Immigration Act or any other law that actually says you can't do this. And so, as a result, they've had to rely mainly on very broad general policies, like Congress wants to discourage illegal immigration, this might hinder that goal, and so on. But I think that if I had to make the strongest argument, and I really don't find this one persuasive, even it would be that there's a fear that if President Obama can do this, the argument is future presidents might be able to ignore laws that they personally disagree with, like the environmental laws or the labor laws or the civil rights laws. In testimony before Congress, I tried to make the point that there are actually several concrete limits on executive enforcement discretion, and tried to explain why this particular action fully respects all of those limits. So I understand the concern about drawing principled limits, but many limits really do exist.
Annie, in the Ninth Circuit case, the Ninth Circuit panel heard oral arguments 9 months ago. Is that a long period of time between oral arguments and a decision when it was a unanimous decision?
It's not unusual for there to be that length of a period of time. You have to remember that in this particular decision came after the end of a case at the summary judgment and issuance of a permanent injunction. So if the issue was whether a preliminary injunction should be upheld by the Ninth Circuit or some other type of ruling by the district court that required expedited review, you would have seen a faster decision.
So, Stephen, according to your reasoning, would the court, the best way for the Supreme Court to get out of this would be to say there's no standing here and not reach the other issues?
That would certainly be the cleanest way to do it and the fastest way because, as you say, that would avoid the need to address some of these other more complicated issues. But they also could say that really the Administrative Procedure Act is clear in saying you don't need this notice and comment procedure if you're adopting, if you're simply announcing how you plan to exercise discretion in the future, which is what I would think this is. And there are pretty strong arguments on the merits as well. So So I think, yes, that would be the fastest way, but not the only way.
And finally, Annie, how much of a victory is this Ninth Circuit decision for the Obama administration?
Well, I think it's a significant victory. Not only is it going to allow Dreamers, recipients of deferred action in the state of Arizona, to continue to receive driver's licenses, which really fulfill the promise of the DACA program and help to integrate Dreamers into the communities where they have been living. It is a broader statement about the DACA program, which has been a center of controversy in recent years, and the Ninth Circuit's issuing of a decision that says that the DACA program was a lawful exercise of authority should be a victory for the administration.
Thank you both for being on Bloomberg Law. That's Professor Annie Lay of the University of California Irvine School of Law and Professor Stephen Legomski of the Washington University Law School. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks to our technical director, Jeannie Lucar, and our producer, David Sutcherman. A special edition of Taking Stock is up next right here on Bloomberg Radio. And remember, you can find more legal news at BloombergLaw.com and BloombergBNA.com, plus a new website for the legal community at biglawbusiness.com. I'm June Grosso. Have a great evening.